français. Okay. Donc pas se tromper, sinon là,
ah bah non, on est mal. C'est...
Donc voilà, ça, ça va avec ceux-là, et ça, c'est tous ceux, les cases français. Mmh. Seulement le petit bleu, mmh, et le laisser sur le 2, comme, okay, comme je les ai mis maintenant.
Ça voilà. Va.
Et ça. Okay. Ok, alors je vais passer à...
français.
Oui, oui, c'est Cécile qui fait l'anglais retour.
Donc moi, je vais parler en français parce que ma langue originale, c'est le français. Voilà. Donc je veux...
Le retour naar het Engels. Is dat aan, dat ding, ja? Attends. Even mijn telefoon uitzetten hier. Moi sans mes lunettes, mais attends, hein, parce que normalement je les ai tous mis sur 2, donc si tu n'as pas tourné à ça, c'est
si
bon, tu as
ça,
tourné, alors attends, est-ce que c'est un 1 ou un 2, okay, regarde un peu, parce que moi j'ai mis sur 2 et sans mes lunettes, je vois que dalle, okay. Ça va, voilà, il faut bien que ce soit sur 2, et voilà, et alors voilà, et ça c'est pour le néerlandais, et moi je prends mon micro ici, ik weet niet of je op mute staat momenteel, dan moet je even bekijken, bij mij staat hij op talk, voilà, ik ga zo zitten hier,
it is in English. Ah oui, comment je fais ça? Attends.
Je t'ai pas fait ça pour moi.
Ok. Zoals je wil, of je kunt aan die kant gaan zitten. Als ik zo hier zit, ga jij misschien een beetje verder zitten. Volgens mij is dat wel goed zo. Donc tout cela pour le français. Et anglophones, ils peuvent le prendre aussi, parce que l'anglais sera aussi là-dessus. Ok, donc ils ont les deux. Tu vois? Ok, we gaan naar begin. Voor Nederlands en Frans.
Simultane vertaling naar het Nederlands is beter met Nederlands dan mijn, maar. Donc, si vous avez besoin de traduction,
hebben jullie een nood? Dan moeten jullie gewoon even hier zijn.
Virginie en train de distribuer les casques.
De koptelefoons aan het uitdelen. Frans of Nederlands?
Donc, en fait, cet après-midi, on voulait faire l'ouverture officielle. Donc, je remercie à la
we wilden vandaag ook de officiële inleiding voorzien. Dus ook ze bedanken hier voor la Maison de la Bellone. Want inderdaad, Virginie Jortet die ons heeft onthaald hier. Ons veel geholpen ook hier in la Bellone. We hebben nog niet de gelegenheid gehad het te doen, want het publiek was vrij talrijk en enthousiast.
L'ambassade
Elgaland-Marjolein
est ouverte.
De
les ambassadeurs sont là.
Zijn er. Later, als u er meer uitleg voelt, dan kan dat. Daar is iemand aanwezig.
Les ambassadeurs. Ensuite, pour les installations aussi, malheureusement, celle de Pierre Berthet.
Hebben we. Carmichael, Dominique Gobelet. Dus. Morgen gaat het rustig zo door. We hebben Jussi Parika uitgenodigd. U ziet hier, hij komt uit Cambridge, van ver gekomen om tot hier te zijn, ons toe te spreken. We beginnen met hem omdat we graag dus in Junctions, dus ook via dus de media-archeologie terecht willen. Even ter herinnering. Zeggen wat de media waren. En dat de media in het begin vooral dus diende om in contact te treden met de anderen, met het verre. En evolutie van de media is niet altijd gewoon uit winstoogmerk gebeurd door efficiëntie of controle, door merchandising. Maar ook zat er een ander idee achter. Iets vreemds. Een vreemd idee, iets een beetje paranormaals eigenlijk. En dit verhaal even voor ogen halen is belangrijk om daarna ook een stapje te zetten naar de toekomst. Na Jussi, om 20:30 komt feestles van Benelux. Manu is er om de film te presenteren die in Londen werd gemaakt, dus op basis van camera's die in de stad zijn geplaatst. Hoogjes, science fiction eigenlijk. Iets dat ons ook veel gaat helpen in ons werk voor de toekomst. Zo, en waar stond ik? Ja, waar was ik nog gebleven voor vandaag? Het is een beetje dit traject dat ons gaat leiden tijdens het hele festival. Het is een event, hoe noem je dit? labo, een keuken, hoe noem je het hier eigenlijk? Een beetje van dit, een beetje van dat en misschien wel.
That. Good. At least I can hear my voice really loud and clear. So yeah, thank you, Laurence, and thank you for inviting me here. It's a real honor to be speaking, actually, the first speaker in this what will be, I think, 1 week festival. Yeah, and when I received the email from Laurence, she asked me to kind of share something about media archaeology, and I've been doing, as mentioned, media archaeology touched my earlier book, which was a media archaeology of computer viruses, which reflects my background, which is in cultural history. I'm a historian in a way, but historian that got enthusiastic, a bit too enthusiastic about media theory early on, and hence been trying to incorporate theoretical themes together with media historical themes in order to find new ways to conceptualize media, the history of technical media especially. And that's something that I'm going to be talking during the next, let's say, probably 45 minutes or so. Something on media archaeology as a way of looking into media history connected to imaginary media, but also have a great chance to be talking about my current research, which is on insects, which might sound a bit curious in the context of modern technical media, these small-brained entities, insects. But as you'll soon know, it actually might fit in quite nicely with the theme of, the wonderful sound installations, for example, here that are about ghosts, that are about electronic voice phenomena, and all these things that are on the fringe, on the kind of liminal levels of media, the neglected themes of media. Of course, my take on imaginary media is a bit different, but I think there are much resonance points here. But I would like to start with an image, and picture yourselves in your head an insect media artist or an insect media archaeologist who's trying to imagine a potential weird medium, and while trying to imagine this weird medium, something that's weird to the insect, he or she might come up with that something that actually quite sounds quite everyday for us human beings. For the insect media artist or media archaeologists, the question of what it feels like to perceive with two eyes, two ears, and move with two legs would be a new one, would be a novel idea, instead of the multiple legs and compound eyes that it has to use to maneuver through space. So such uncanny formations are often used, of course, in science fiction to describe something radically unhuman. Think of, for example, the insects in the kind of insect-like creatures in Aliens movies or well, there's a whole history of insects in science fiction, as you know, which are different, radically unhuman in their anatomy, their behavior, and also their morals, so to speak. So true, of course, the human brain might be a much more efficient problem solver, and human hands are quite handy tools, handy tool-making meta-tools in a way, and the human body could be seen as an original form of any model of techniques, as was suggested by Ernst Kapp already at the end of the 19th century. But such realizations do not take away the fascination with the question of what would it be like to move, to perceive, and think differently in a different embodied form, for example, an insect, or for the insects, the human being. Of course, I'm taking my cue here, my idea here, from philosopher Manuel de Landa, who, in his 1991 book, War in the Age of Intelligent Machines, asked what would be the history of warfare, what would the history of warfare look from the point of view of a future imaginary robot historian. An exercise perhaps in creative imagination, Delanda's question also served other ends. Instead of looking at technical systems, material flows and designs of military maneuvers from the point of the human being, whether the plans of a general or the phenomenological world of the everyday ordinary soldier, Delanda proposed a so-called machinic viewpoint that looks beyond the divisions between humans and machines and tries to find the flows, the intensities, the connections, and in general the so-called machinic phylum of self-organization that channels the functioning of weapons and war. Whereas we don't have to go that far and think of what would a robot consciousness be like. That might be an unneeded result of imagination. We still can realize how, for example, missile engines are much more than the sum of their inventors' thoughts, because they consist of stages of matter self-organizing, such as the propulsion, where impulse and direction are imparted to the projectile, the ballistic stage concerning the trajectory of flight, and also the impact stage concerning the effects of the missile on its hoped target. Well, my point is not to discuss Delanda, or not to discuss the history of modern warfare, but I want to pick up this idea, this kind of an approach, an idea that could be integrated into media archaeological considerations concerning actual or imaginary media. As already said, imagining alternative worlds is not the end point of this exercise in insect media, but a way to dip into alternative understandings of media and technology, where such general categories as humans and machines are merely the endpoints of intensive flows, capacities, tendencies, and functions. Such a stance takes much of its ideas from Gilles Deleuze's, the French philosopher Gilles Deleuze's philosophical ontology of abstract materialism, which focuses primarily on a Spinozian ontology of intensities, capacities, and functions. In this sense, the human being ourselves has certain kind of capacities to sense, to perceive, to think, to memorize, and so forth. The human being is not so much a distinct being in the world with secondary qualities, but it's defined by the capacities to signify, exchange, and communicate, as, for example, Claire Colebrook has pointed out based on Deleuze. This opens up a whole new focus, not focused on beings and their tools, but on the capacities and tendencies making up beings in a move, which emphasizes, for example, Deleuze's interest in pre-Kantian worlds of Baroque, which is a fitting, of course, in this Baroque building, of at least half a Baroque building. Similarly, this move includes a multiplication of subjectivities, a multiplication of objects of the world, a certain autonomy of the material world beyond the privileged observer that used to be, of course, the male gazing subject. So to put it shortly, again following Colebrook's recent writings on the concept of affect, what Deleuze found in Baroque worlds of windowless monads was a capacity of perception that does not stem from a universalizing idea of perception in general. Man or any general condition of perception is not the primary privileged position of perception, but perceptions and creations of space and temporality are multiplied in the numerous monadic worlds, a distributed perception of a kind that later, according to Deleuze, found a resonance in the philosophy of A.N. Whitehead. Here, the perceiving subject is more akin to a superject, a second-order construction from the sum of its perceptions. Baroque worlds, argues Deleuze in his book Le Pli, The Fold, from 1988, are characterized by the primacy of variation and perspectivism, which is much more radical of a notion than a relativist idea of different subjects having different perspectives to the world, of different animals having different perspectives to the world. Instead, the subject will be what comes to the point of view, and where the point of view is not what varies with the subject, at least in the first instance. It is, to the contrary, the condition in which an eventual subject apprehends a variation or a metamorphosis. Well, now why on earth this focus on philosophy or this short excursion into something that seemingly might not be relevant to our topic or the festival here? What I am after is an idea of how to smuggle certain ideas of perceptions into considerations of media culture, media archaeology, and potentially also imaginary media, where imaginary media becomes less a matter of Lacanian mirror face looking for utopian communication offering unity, but a deterritorializing force, deterritorializing way of understanding the distributed ontology of the world and media technologies. So variation and imagination become something else than the imaginations of a point of view. Quite the contrary, the imagination, variation, give rise to points of view, which open up a whole new agenda of past, paradoxically not determined, and further so, future as open to variation. This would mean taking into account perceptions unheard of, unthought, but still potentially real, a becoming other of the sensorium, so to speak. Now, being here and talking about imaginary media, I would feel ashamed not to mention the recent book edited by Eric Klautenberg, The Book of Imaginary Media. According to the introduction of the book, all media consists of real and imaginary parts, a functional coupling of material characteristics and discursive dreams which make up the crucial features of modern communication that tied intimately in utopian ideals. So imaginary media or actual media imagined beyond its real capacities have been hoped to compensate insufficient communication, a realization that Klautenberg continues with the argument that central to the archaeology of imaginary media in the end are not the machines, but the human aspirations that more often than not are left unresolved by the machines. Powers of imagination are then based in the human being doing the imaginings, in the human powers able to transcend the actual and factual ways of perception and grasp the unseen, unheard and unthought of media creations. Of course, talking of the primacy of variation, we are easily reminded of Siegfried Zielinski's application of the idea of variantology as an archaeology of media, a task dedicated to the primacy of variation, resisting the homogeneous drive of commercializing media sphere. So excavating dreams of past geniuses from Empedocles to Athanasius Curtius' cosmic machines and communication networks to, for example, Ernst Florenz Friedrich Chladni's visualization of sound, Zielinski has been underlining the creative potential in this exercise of imagining media throughout Western history. This he defines in a threefold form. Firstly, untimely media or apparatuses or untimely machines, which are media devised and designed either too much too late or much too early. Secondly, conceptual media or machines, artifacts that were only ever sketched as models. Of course, history is again filled with these. And thirdly, impossible media or apparatus or machines, which are hermetic, according to Zielinski, hermetic and hermeneutic machines. They cannot be actually be built, and whose implied meanings nonetheless have an impact on the factual world of media. So there's a thing going on having to do with imagination with still having real effects to our actual perception of media or in media. So this is, of course, a bit reminiscent of the Baroque idea, that this idea that variation is primary, which also Zielinski seems to be proposing to us. Whereas the capitalist-orientated consumer media culture is working to what he calls a psychopathia medialis of homogenized media technological environments, variantology is committed to promoting heterogeneity, finding dynamic moments of media archaeological past, and excavating radical experiments that push the limits of what can be seen, heard, and thought. Naturally, the aim of promoting diversity is a much welcomed idea, but I still would like to propose a slight adjustment to this agenda, something that I try to engage under the banner of insect media or insect theory of media, a term which should be read or heard at least a bit ironically. Whereas Zielinski and much of the existing media archaeological research, like Erkki Huhtamo's work, still starts off from the human world of male inventors, I would propose to a bit more distributed look at the media archaeology of affects, capacities, modes of perception and movement, which are not primarily attached to a specific substance in the first instance, not a specific substance like animals or technology, but actually, since the 19th century at least, refer to a certain passage, a certain vector from animals to technology and vice versa. Here, this kind of a mode of Baroque thought, a thought that is tuned in terms of variations, becomes unraveled with the help of animality that is not to be seen merely as a metaphorics, but as metamorphoses, as teachings, in weird perceptions, novel ways of moving, new ways of sensing, opening up the world of sensations and contracting new sensations. Instead of looking for variations through inventions of people, human beings, we can turn to the storehouses of invention of, for example, insects, that from the 19th century on, at least, were introduced as an alien form of media in themselves. So, basically, what I'm proposing is that we jump on the back of certain insects that since 19th century have been kind of, this is not of course a major theme as we know, it's a more kind of a bubbling under theme since the 19th century of thinking of insects as techniques of nature in a way. I'm trying to propose how insects were during the latter half of the century, 19th century, and since then seen as uncanny but powerful forms of media in themselves, capable of weird sensory and kinesthetic experiences. Basically examples, concrete examples, range from popular newspaper discourse to scientific measurements and such early bestsellers as the book that you can see the name here, Introduction to Entomology by Kirby and Spence, or Elements of the Natural History of Insects, comprising an account of noxious and useful insects, of their metamorphoses, hibernation, and instincts, from four volumes between 1815 and 1826. Since the 19th century, insects and animal affects are not found only in biology, but in art, technology, popular culture, and so on. So what I want to focus on now next is how the 19th century interest towards insects produces a valuable perspective towards the intertwining between biology as in entomology, insect research, and technology and art, where the basics of perception are radically detached from human-centered models towards the animal kingdom. In addition, this science, technology, art trio presents a challenge to rethink the forces which form what we habitually refer to as media, as modes of perception. So basically by expanding our notions of media from the technological apparatuses to the more comprehensive assemblages which connect issues biological, technological, social, aesthetic, we are able to bring forth novel contexts also for contemporary analysis and design of media systems. So in a way then, the concept of the insect functions here also as a conceptual notion, conceptual person, as a displacing, a deterritorializing force that seeks a questioning of where and in what kind of conditions we approach media technologies. So this is perhaps an approach that moves beyond focus on technology per se, but still does not neglect the material forces of the world. Of course, examples give this bit vague idea a bit more concrete edge. And a couple of examples from 19th century popular discourse are quite illuminating, so to speak. New York Times address in 1897, spiders as builders, engineers, and weavers, and also as the original inventors of the system of telegraphy. Spiders' webs offer themselves as ingenious communication systems, which do not merely signal according to a binary setting that something has hit the web or something has not hit the web, but transmit also information regarding the general character and weight of any object touching it. Similar accounts abound since the mid-19th century. Insects sense, move, build, communicate, and even create art in various ways that raised wonder and awe, for example, in the US popular culture. apt example of the 19th century insect mania is this quote, a short newspaper story of a certain young lady who collected and trained crickets as musical instruments. As the quote goes, 300 crickets in a wirework house filled with ferns and shells, which she called a fernery. The constant rubbing of the wings of these insects, producing the sounds so familiar to thousands everywhere, seemed to be the finest music to her ears. She admitted at once that she had a mania for capturing insects. So besides entertainment, and in much earlier framework, the classic of modern entomology, the aforementioned Kirby and Spence book, it also already presented implicitly throughout this four-volume bestseller the idea of primitive techniques of nature, insect techniques that was immanent to their surroundings. I think Kirby and Spence's take attracted the attention it did, probably because it of course, the catchy language, but also what could be called its ethological touch before the time of etology as we understand it nowadays. Insects were approached as living and interacting entities that are intimately coupled with their environment, yet presented as active participants and constructors. Insects, of course, intertwine with human lives and cause, for example, damage to crops, but also engage in ingenious building projects, stratagems, sexual behavior, and other expressive modes of motion, perception, and sensation. Instead of pertaining to a taxonomic account of the interrelations between insect species, their forms, their growth, or their, for example, structural anatomy, their book Introduction to Entomology is traversed by a certain curiosity cabinet kind of a touch, which illuminates a certain ethnographics of insect techniques. Here, insects are, for example, war machines, as the example horsefly, which is described as a wonderful and various other weapons that enable them to enforce their demand. What would you think of any large animal that should come to attack you with a tremendous apparatus of knives and lancets issuing from its mouth? So, from Kirby and Spence to later entomologists and other writers, insects' powers of building continuously attracted the early entomological gaze, and builders of nature were described as outstanding, the pyramids of Egypt and aqueducts of Rome. So suddenly, in this weird parallel world, such minuscule and, as said, admittedly small-brained entities like termites were pictured as like to the ancient monarchies and empires of Western civilization. So if the Victorian era valued the history of civilization, which was increasingly, of course, as we know, throughout the 19th century, transported as integral part of museum collections in Europe, then this kind of an insect overturning of the agenda, overturning of appreciation of history of civilization and architecture, was indeed a curious kind of valuation. Of course, we don't have to take it literally, but still it seems to express a curious kind of interest towards microcosmical worlds. A kind of a recurring trope, a recurring topic, a theme, was that of insect geometrics, which seems with accuracy paralleled only by mathematics to follow and fold nature's resources into microversions of emerging urban culture. Here I have another quote, rather longish one, but it's quite apt in the sense of how it describes this infatuation with insects as well. I'm going to read it aloud, even though it's over there. No thinking man ever witnesses the complexness and yet regularity and efficiency of a great establishment, such as the Bank of England or the Post Office, without marveling that even human reason can put together, with so little friction and such slight deviations from correctness, machines whose wheels are composed not of wood and iron, but of fickle mortals of a thousand different inclinations, powers, and capacities. But if such establishments be surprising even with reason for their prime mover, how much more so is the hive of bees, whose proceedings are guided by their instincts alone. So this quote is again from the aforementioned Kirby and Spence book, Introduction to Entomology, but as I said, these examples are various, and they seem to be even more than when we approach the turn of the fin de siècle of 19th, 20th century. And of course, something that is a curious theme, how this was fed into the actual interests of the architects, of the modern architects of 20th century. There's a wonderful book by a Spanish researcher, whose name I just can't remember now, on I think it's called From Gaudi to Le Corbusier, where these insect metaphors in architecture are discussed in length. But, so, whereas the imperialist powers, for example Britain as one of the leading examples, headed for overseas conquests, were of course in the 19th century still, the mentality of exposition and mapping new terrains turned also towards other fields than geographical. So basically, the seeing eye, the key figure of hierarchical modern power, the seeing eye, the seeing gaze, could be also, in this idea, it could also be a non-human eye, as with the fly, which according to Stephen Connor can be seen as the recurring mode of radically alien mode of entomological vision, with its huge eyes consisting of 4,000 sensors. So in this sense, it's quite fitting that how in the year 1898, the idea of photographing through a fly's eye was suggested as a mode of experimental vision, and also, as was suggested in the same story, it was able to catch Queen Victoria with the most infinitesimal lens known to science, that of the dragonfly. The philosopher Jean-Jacques Le Cercle, in his book Philosophy of Nonsense, notes how this certain Victorian enthusiasm for entomology, insect research, and insect worlds is related to a larger natural history, general discourse of natural history, that as a genre labeled the 19th century. Through the themes of exploration and taxonomy, Le Cercle claims how Alice in Wonderland can be read as a key novel of the era in its evaluation of and classification of various life worlds beyond the normal human being. So like Alice in the 1865 novel, new landscapes and exotic species are offered as an armchair exploration of worlds, not merely extensive, but also open up by the certain intensive gaze of into the microcosms. So uncanny phenomenal worlds are what tie together the entomological quest also with Darwinian-inspired worlds, or Darwinian biological accounts of curious species, and these Alice in Wonderland's adventures into imaginative worlds of twisting logic and uncanny perceptions. In taxonomic terms, the entomologist is surrounded by a new cult of archiving in private and public collections. As we know, the 19th century is filled with archives, from Bucks to the museums that I mentioned that are collecting the stuff from colonialist countries and so forth, colonialized countries. New modes of visualizing and representing insect forms of life produce a new phase of taxonomy becoming a public grace instead of merely a scientific tool. But again here, the wonder worlds of Alice in Wonderland or Edward Lear, the Victorian nonsense poet, are the ideal points of reference for 19th century natural historian and entomologists. And this is a quote from Le Cercle that kind of sums up much of the connections between entomology and other views into explorations into experimental worlds. So Le Cercle writes, and it's part of a craze for discovering and classifying new species. Its advantage over natural history is that it can invent those species, like the snap dragonfly, in the imaginative sense, whereas natural history can invent them only in the archaeological sense, that is, discover what already exists. So nonsense is the entomologist's dream come true, or the Linnaean classification gone mad, because gone creative. So again, Alice in Alice in Wonderland, for her, the feeling of not being herself and being so many different sizes in a day is very confusing, which of course is not incomprehensible to the caterpillar she encounters. It is not queer for the caterpillar, whose mode of being is defined by the metamorphosis and the various perception action modulations it brings about. It is only the suddenness of this becoming insect that of Alice that dizzies her, makes her feel dizzy. A couple of years later, in the population of an old pear tree or stories of insect life from 1870, an everyday meadow is disclosed as a vivacious microcosmos in itself. The harmonious scene, like a great amphitheater, is filled with life that easily escapes the human eye. Like Alice, the protagonist wandering in the meadow is lulled and benumbed by dreamy sensations, which however transport him suddenly into new perceptions and new bodily affects. So what is revealed to our boy hero in this educational novel fashioned in the style of travel literature, of course, which connects it to the colonialist discourses of his age, what is disclosed or what is revealed is a world teeming with sounds, filled with sounds, movements, sensations, and insect beings like huge spiders, cruel mole crickets, energetic bees, and so forth, that are beyond the human form, despite, of course, we have to realize that there's a constant tension of such narratives as educational and also moralizing tales that do anthropomorphize, make human the affective qualities of the kind of a more radical world, kind of a channel them into human characteristics. Of course, true to the entomological classification, this craze for classification, a big part of the book is reserved for the structural anatomical differences of the insect life, but also the affect life of relating to the surroundings of insects is something that is under scrutiny here. So basically, as precursors of later ethological ways of understanding insect life, animal life, and so forth, such natural historical quests, whether archaeological, entomological, or imaginative, they seem to be expressing an appreciation of phenomenal worlds that differ from the human being with its two hands, two eyes, two feet, and so forth. In a way, this entailed a kind of an extended Kantianism, which was interested in the a priori conditions of alternative life worlds. So curiously, this inspiration with new phenomenal worlds was connected to the emergence of new technologies of movements, sensation and communication, as well as challenging that Kantian apperception of man as the historically constant basis of knowledge and perception. Nature was gradually becoming the new storehouse of invention that was to entice inventors into perfecting their developments. Of course, for example, the most obvious example from the end of the 19th century is the research into flying by, for example, Etienne Jules Marais, who's usually hailed as one of the forefathers of cinematic movement. He was very actively engaging in looking into how physiologically insects and of course birds as well are able to fly. I'm trying to find the image. Yes, here you see one of Marais' early insect machines. He didn't only just physiologically measure of what kind of a movements insect flight consists of, but he also did reproduction machines, a kind of simulation machines of insect flight, as in the right here. But having mentioned that, so basically, what I'm arguing here is that this whole theme about insects and technology can also be read as an expression of a shift in understanding technology. A shift that, in a way, has been perhaps neglected, but it's still there as an undercurrent, as a bubbling under theme throughout technical history of technical media. A shift that marked the rise of modern discourse concerning media technology since the end of the 19th century, and that has usually been attributed to an anthropological and ethnological turn in understanding technology and media. So for several writers, as the aforementioned Ernst Kapp, who became one of the precedents of later theories of media as extensions of man, as we know, of course, Marshall McLuhan was one of the most well-known media theorists of that school of thought. For those guys, it was the human body that seemed to serve as the storage house of potential media. However, at the same time, another undercurrent proposed to think of technologies, inventions, and solutions to problems posed by life as stemming from a much more different class of bodies, namely insects. Of course, I'm not stupid. I'm not claiming that insects is all there is, but it's kind of it's a vector that we can use to kind of a dip into this world of animal affects and technologies. So basically, beyond Immanuel Kant, we move onto a Baroque world, not as a period of art, but as a mode of folding and enveloping new ways of perception and movement. The early years and decades of technical media were characterized with the new imaginary of communication, from work by inventors like Nikola Tesla to various modes of, for example, spiritualism, analyzed recently in her artworks by Zoe Beloff, and of course the wonderful electronic voice phenomena installation we have there is in a way connects to this media archaeology of early media archaeology, where 19th century spiritualism was seen also as a media that mediated from the world of the dead to us human beings. However, we can radicalize the viewpoint furthermore and take an animal turn and look for not alien but animal and insect ways of sensing the world, perceiving the world. Naturally, this is of course exactly what has been proposed in various media art pieces and exhibitions, and probably in an increasing pace. However, one should not reside on the level of intriguing representations of imagined ways of communication or imagined apparatuses that never took place, but realize the overabundance of real sensations, the perceptions to contract, to fold, a certain neo-materialist view towards imagined media. So, I'm nearing the end of the presentations. Insects have made an appearance, for example, in Toshio Iwai's Music Insects piece from 1990. David Dunn's acoustic ecology pieces with insect sounds. Also the Psy Art biorobotic choreography project from 2001 with Stellark as one of the participators. You see the image here. You actually can see the funny resemblance between the images where the previous form from the novel, the population of old Pear Tree with kind of a contrast or actually the parallel between the technologies of walking and spiders who actually introduced this kind of a method, and then Stellark's project here. And for example, in addition, Laura Beloff's Spinne from 2002 networked spider installation, working according to the web spider and or crawler technology. So basically, it's not just a question of representing the insect, but engaging with animal affects, non-distinguishable from those of the technological, as in Stellark's work, where the experimentation with new bodily realities is a form of becoming insect of the technological human body. But to take another example, a less known one, I want to end this presentation by giving an example of the novel Audio Worlds of Insects, a recording of the emergence in a pond, a certain kind of a weird sound environment that seems to hint towards certain ideas of technological music, but in this case, made by a collection of insect sounds. Here as well, the imagined, if we should think of this as imagined media, does not mean so much imagined as human imagined, but as alternative, uncanny, non-human worlds of affect and perception, but which are continuously folded as part of the experimental media culture of recent years. And in a way, I think this in a nice way relates to the sound pieces we have here, because it's here we have a certain contracting of insect worlds with technological means of recording, and which kind of a taken out of their contexts, tune our senses towards these microcosmical sounds. So hopefully let's see, just a short 30-second excerpt. I think I will end here this wonderful electroacoustic insect worlds, and yeah, that's about it. Thank you.
Merci.
Tu dois me mettre là.
Get you on screen again.
S'il te plaît. Si... Merci. C'est... Mais on... Même si on change.
Do you want to use this?
Oh, sorry for this. Because we're recording everything, that's technology, the master. I don't move, maintenant. Donc, on a un peu de temps. Merci, Yussi, c'est ça que je voulais dire. Thank you. Oui, on a un peu de temps pour les questions. On peut aussi faire ça en, de manière plus conviviale, c'est comme vous voulez. Donc, est-ce qu'il y a une question? C'est toujours difficile. It's always difficult. Hein, don't worry. Yeah. So I have one. Yeah, because donc for the translators, I cannot speak in English. You know, it's bothering. So I give you. Ça marche? Oh, it's...
No.
Yeah,
it's done.
Hmm? Voilà. Comme ça?
Yeah.
En fait, effectivement, si on vous a invité, l'idée était de se déplacer. Dans l'approche des médias pour pouvoir penser autrement que depuis un point de vue qui est généralement mâle, occidental, d'efficacité, et de, enfin, quelle était la projection aussi politique et sociologique qu'on pouvait mettre dans les médias. Et ce qui m'a fait penser évidemment aux féministes qui ont critiqué l'approche d'éthologie, c'est-à-dire l'étude des animaux et spécifiquement l'étude des singes et des bonobos et des babouins. Donc les femmes sont descendues sur le terrain, ont été voir comment ça marchait. Elles se sont rendues compte qu'en fait, l'image patriarcale de l'homme chasse, la femme soigne, etc., enfin, le mâle, la femelle, etc., ne correspondait absolument pas au système de fonctionnement des singes et qu'il y avait beaucoup de variations, comme vous avez dit. Donc là où j'étais un peu sur ma faim dans l'approche sur les insectes, effectivement, se déplacer dans les corps pouvait faire penser à d'autres formes, mais qu'en est-il des relations de pouvoir ou des relations politiques? Et aussi, est-ce que dans le fond, les animaux ne sont jamais que la projection de ce que nous, on veut que ça soit ici et maintenant? Donc votre choix, notre choix d'aller dans l'archéologie des médias ou dans le média du point de vue des insectes, dans le fond, ils vont dire que ce qu'on veut entendre, c'est-à-dire qu'un autre monde est possible. Mais. Donc voilà.
Ok, thank you. I actually missed the early part of the question, but I think I can still follow that one. Yeah, that's true. Absolutely, they're kind of a gender take in within insect research and within the popular culture of insects has been around very, very actively. One can find really weird stuff being the old entomological research and the popular culture, like New York Times from the 19th century. One of the most kind of evident references to insects was how the kind of a reluctance to understand that actually in the bee world, the one who's in charge or the queen, it was early on kind of a reluctance to see her as a queen, and once continuously referred to as king before 19th century entomology. Was at least people had to admit that actually it is the queen. That's anatomically. And one of kind of funny examples that emerged around early 20th century, just the first year, was a curious kind of a discussion about the third sex in insect research. Basically, some insect research had been suggesting that there's a third sex that doesn't kind of abide by the human world division of male, female, but there's something that doesn't just fit in the world. And this was kind of a discussed for a while, also in popular culture, as of how does this feed in, what does this suggest to the human world as well, because of course, it's kind of this danger of sociobiology that we are adopting straightforward the models of from biological behavior to the human worlds. But it's a curious kind of alternative sociobiology here that's acting. Of course, the kind of during the recent decades, it's usually been the other way around, that it's people are usually finding the justifications for a certain male-led patriarchal society from worlds of animals. But there's kind of a potentiality of, at least ironically, looking in the worlds and trying to translate these into a certain feminist agenda as well, absolutely. And I think what interests me is beyond this kind of a curious historical examples, is the resonance, the parallels of how during the recent years certain radical neo-materialist feminists like Elizabeth Cross and Rosie Pridotti have been trying to incorporate insects and animals and their affectual worlds into thinking the notion of sexual difference. Of course, Cross, in her recent books, has been rereading Darwin, which usually, of course, is again read as a kind of a patriarchal name that suggests merely towards a very conservative social cultural notions. But actually, according to Cross, we can find a radical sexual difference from Darwin's writings. And similarly, Pridotti has been, of course, suggesting towards seeing the insect and through the insect as a parallel, as a figure of thought which could be adopted as part of the cyberfeminist or materialist feminist project as well. So there's a whole field overlapping between insects and women. I would dare to say the certain minoritarian voices. That's why probably radical feminism or kind of a material feminist has been trying to think through embodied beings through these notions of affectivity and also adopting them from the animal worlds. Thank you.
So I try again. The following was about the politics behind changing the viewpoint. It's not actually changing the academy would be the best. I mean, because to go to media archaeology, to insect media, it's like, do you think another world is possible? But it's not the world is what we make it or how we look at it. So it depends on your political agenda, what you want to see in insect. So, yeah.
Absolutely, it's kind of a important thing is to know the tensions in this kind of an agenda, in the sense that I already mentioned there's the horrible danger of certain straightforward socio-biologism where we just adopt without translations models from the insect world, from the animal world, and so forth. So instead, it has to be done in a very careful one option is theoretically informed way of understanding how to translate the ideas about affects and new phenomenal worlds into a politics of perception, into a politics of sensation, where that's why I wanted to end with the MediaArt examples, is that there's the wonderful stuff being done there as well. Not just representing the insects, but trying to figure out what would it mean to perceive, to sense, to move in a different way from the usual two-legged, two-armed way of human, the way we human beings are constructed. And again, this is the connection point between politics of, for example, feminism and politics of animal affects. And we just to mention that naturally, of course, the kind of the fact is that, for example, insect models of organization and social insects and their way of constructing society were during 19th century, during early years of 20th century, easily incorporated into a patriarchal agenda, or at least at times even to a totalitarian agenda, as with the enthusiasm for Meyer the Bee in Germany and throughout Europe in the early years of 20th century. Of course, you know Meyer the Bee, the wonderful children cartoon, which was adopted as part of Nazi agenda as well. There are similar examples of these children's rhymes, children's tunes, children's comics from the early part of 20th century, which were kind of educating as to be how to be a model citizen and how to sacrifice yourself for the state. Thank you.
I would like to maybe you to clarify a little bit what would mean to have like an insect point of view, because I still see that somehow there is an interpretation that is some, in a way based on mechanistic views, like either the insect as a worker or as a part of a machine or as a weapon. If I start to think, then maybe I think, yeah, maybe the insect is like the materialization of an ecology, and that's a bit more different. But what in your view would be more like the insect point of view?
Thank you. That's absolutely true. That, for example, a lot of the examples here and are referring to already intuitive ideas we have about technology, about weapons, war, building, architecture, and so forth. So that's absolutely true. So we have to be working on the fringes here, and hence, for example, a lot of the stuff doing in the, I use the vague term media art now, but a lot of the stuff done there could be seen in this sense as working towards phenomenal worlds that are not recognizable beforehand, and hence trying to suggest certain becoming other of the human being. Whether it's explicitly used the term insects or animals there, or whether it's just implicitly there. And hence I tried to kind of use the figure of the insect also as a passage, a certain vector of imagination, so it kind of a promise of another way of perceiving, and suggesting that, for example, the human being with a priori conditions of perceiving, that the a priori conditions are never kind of a beforehand locked and determined, but there's always the possibility of opening up ourselves to something that we haven't heard before, a kind of a idea that, in a way, it's funny that how Darwin already suggested towards this idea. This is something that artificial life research has, of course, been trying to do, how to come up with such notions of life that are not just reproducing the ideas that we have, and hence kind of a reproducing the human bias of it all. And in a way, Darwin already proposed this in Origin of Species and other writings, that basically in his genealogy of biology and biological species, he continuously hinted towards the open-ended future, that the kind of a the we are not determined as a species to remain as we are. There's no mechanistic. In this sense, it's intriguing how, for example, Elizabeth Cross reads Darwin in the context of Henri Bergson and Nietzsche and radical temporality, and hence radical openness towards new phenomenal worlds, for example. So I'm trying to go through that path. And for example, when you read Henri Bergson's L'Evolution Créatrice from the early 20th century, the philosophical work, it's filled with... Bergson as well is enthusiastic about insects, because that's a whole another way of seeing the world instead of the intelligent human being, the instinctual insect being. So that's actually a whole philosophy of insects as well.
In your research, maybe in the past or in the future, have you thought of making a link to peer-to-peer strategies and ways of organization? Because, I mean, you've talked about social structures, etc. Maybe we could go in there to touch the political?
Thank you. Yeah, it's true. Well, my stuff on computer viruses and the kind of media archaeology of accidents didn't touch too much on peer-to-peer networks. And I haven't written anything yet about the logic of, for example, networking in that sense. Of course, there's people doing kind of that's the intriguing part as well. Something I didn't mention explicitly now is that, of course, there are a huge amount of people who have before me adopted the insect concepts as part of media theory and understanding of networks. Notions as the whole notion about distribution, distributed intelligence, swarms, and so forth have been popping up since the 1990s. So, in a way, of course, I'm jumping on a bandwagon now. But, and it's absolutely true, I don't have a clear vision of what I would say about the connections between peer-to-peer networks, but there's an absolutely connection. And what interests me is this: how this translation is done from swarms to human communication on peer-to-peer networks, and the whole notions about distribution. And one solution is to go try to rigorously, and of course in a bit ironical way as well, to see, go down the path and look how swarms as a concept emerges from insect research and becomes adopted into consideration of social networks. And what does this borrowing of biological concept mean in this sense? And yeah, it's absolutely a fascinating topic.
Merci. Il y a encore une autre question, ou alors de toute façon on va allumer les lumières en espérant que ça nous chauffe un petit peu. Et maintenant il y a à des prix tout à fait modiques, mais ça tout le monde s'en fout sur le stream, franchement. À des prix modiques, vous pouvez manger ce soir à la Bellone. Cool, mais vous n'êtes pas là. Donc il y a de quoi manger, de quoi boire ici. Donc tout à l'heure, à la fin du dîner, donc vers 8h, 8h30, nous aurons le plaisir d'avoir Manu Lux qui viendra présenter son film Faceless, et nous verrons le film Faceless en première en Belgique, parce qu'il sera en deuxième pendant le festival de la Ligue des droits de l'homme, la semaine thématique Le quotidien sous contrôle, dont Peter vous parlera tout à l'heure et vous donnera la date précise au mois de décembre. Voilà, donc à tout à l'heure et merci encore.